Harry Carey and Steve Stone. Here are the lineups for Terry Francona's starting lineup of Cummings in center, Sipsik in second, Rowland in third, Brodna at first, Lieberthal the catcher, Robertson in left, Barron in right, Stocker the shortstop, and Matt Beach is on the hill. He's won four and lost nine. The Pepsi defense against that alignment, Lowry in left, Glanville in center, Sosa in right, Ori, Hernandez, Sandberg, and Grace around the infield. Jeremiah Gonzalez on the hill. Mike Hubbard behind the plate.
Welcome back to another exciting edition of the Pointless Exercise Podcast. I know you've missed it. It's time once again to remember this crap with Mike Donahue. Only now we're not remembering Bears crap. We're remembering Cubs crap. Mike, how are you?
I'm great, Andy. Just let's be honest. 16 game season compared to 162. It's a whole lot more crap.
I'm no mathematician, but it's like 10 times more crap. Is that right? I think that's right. Before we get started, big, I want to give everybody the exciting podcast lineup now on Pointless Exercise here in the spring. Mike Pusateri and I just finished our third movie deep dive podcast. We added Major League to the oeuvre. I like to use that word once a podcast.
Nice pronunciation. I didn't know how that was pronounced.
I doubt that's how it's actually pronounced. You can on the podcast feed, you could find a movie deep dive into Major League. You could find a movie deep dive into Moneyball, and you can find a movie deep dive into The Right Stuff. And we are currently doing our homework for the next one, which is Rounders. This podcast is back now on a semi-monthly, bi-monthly. Bi-monthly is twice a month and twice. I don't know.
Well, I think that's one of those odd one-offs in the English language where bi-weekly means every 2 weeks and twice a week, yes. If I'm not mistaken. So you need more context.
So anyway, like twice a month, we're going to remember crap. And now we're going to remember crap about the Cubs. And then next week, it's the triumphant return of the Cubs podcast. And though he threatened to quit, we talked him out of it. He talked himself out of it. Sam is back, and so is Kyle. We've kept stability on the roster. Everybody's back for the spring. It's very exciting.
It's, I guess, more than you can say for the Cubs.
All right, so now the way the Cub thing is going to work, because we have to complicate things as much as possible, we are going to, at random, pick a year, and we're just going to talk about that season. And the way we're going to do it, if you've listened to the Movie Deep Dive podcast, we have a wheel. And we spin the wheel, and that tells us what the next movie is going to be. Except in that one, we fudge it. Because I have a wheel of movies I picked, Mike Pusateri has a wheel of movies he picked, and we have this joint wheel that we both picked. And then somebody wins the podcast, and then they get to pick what we do. And this one, there's none of that crap. We have a wheel that has every year from 1980 to 2011... And we're just going to spin that SOB at the beginning of the podcast, and wherever it lands, that's what we have to talk about that night. With no homework, why would we want to do any research? That's researching this crap.
Yeah, I don't want to do any work. It's all up here.
Yes. We're remembering crap. We're not researching it.
32 years of crap. And I can say that without denigrating our recent World Series victories, because we're stopping at 2011. We don't need to rehash the recent success. I think it's kind of fresh. Everyone knows it. Everyone has their own take. You know, nothing's going to really stand out. Many observations about the 2015, 2016 Cubs. Plus, to do so, I think, would just probably make us sad, because we're still not too far removed from it and would have thought that things would have continued to remain at that level for a few more years.
I'll tell you who's going to be mad about the cutoff. Dale Sveen.
We won't have a Dale Sveen mention outside of tonight. Yep. Although I doubt that's true.
I feel like I've talked about this before, but when I was at the Athletic, I got assigned to remember the 2012 Cubs roster. And that's enough for me. You guys can go read that.
Yeah. Well, by doing so, you become an expert because as much as I can boast about, you know, knowing all kinds of pointless facts about so many Cubs teams throughout the years, there is that real black period, that black hole before Theo was hired. After 2008, when they broke me, when the 98-win Cubs team got swept out of the playoffs after having only led four innings total. And I won't say any more about that till the wheel lands on 2008. But
you know what's good about, what's good about Marquee? They never remind you. It's not like they constantly remind you about that team's failure with the fucking poster boy for that failure being foisted upon us in every show. And they can't understand why there's a relatively large segment of Cub fans who despise him. And we don't care that he may kiss Crane's ass and make everybody feel like he's this great guy. He's still the guy who walks seven Dodgers in a playoff game.
We'll get to him, Andy, when we do 2004 and 2008. Not just the seven Dodgers.
I got this idea for the 2012 Cubs. I'll consult with my lawyer, who used to be on the Cub podcast with us. He's the best one I can afford because he's free. Some week when we decide we need a week off, I'll just record myself reading the column I wrote for The Athletic. It'll be like an audiobook version of it. Because I'm sure I own the intellectual property of that, right? It's not like they own it just because they paid me to do it. Oh, that's probably a flaw in that idea.
Yeah, but are they really going to, you know, send their lawyers after you?
I would say I would just read the parts I left out. But as everybody knows, you don't leave anything out of anything. You just get all the crap and you have to sort through it yourself.
Yeah, especially when you're talking about the 2012 Cubs.
Yes, it's all crap. All right.
So yeah, if you want 2012, you can get that in the addenda that you may just.
Well, we'll have a special edition. If the fans clamor for it, we'll do a special edition of the podcast all about Jason Birkin and the Japanese guy that I can't remember his name. I didn't even know was on the team. And he pitched like five times.
I don't even know who Jason Birkin is.
And, I'm not sure that his parents claim him anymore.
And if he has, but if he has an equivalent on any team on the 80s, I would know who that is. But no, 2012, yeah.
All right, so we got enough preamble. We're going to fire this up, and we're going to see what year we're going to talk about tonight. It's like being on The Price is Right. Did it go all the way around? Hey! The year of our Lord, 1997. Nothing exciting happened that year, did it?
Certainly not in Chicago in general. That could open up a can of worms. I'm sorry, that is just too perfect that we are starting with 1997. I guess I would have been taken aback by any years, but, you know, free association, top of my head, you've got Kevin Ori starting the season at third base on opening day, from whence the Cubs, of course, lose their first 14 games of the year, and Jeremy Gonzalez made his debut, and Kevin Tapney joined the Cubs, and, oh boy, I can't wait to discuss this for the next hour, Andy. Woohoo! The 1997 Cubs. That's it. Bring it on.
All right, so one of the things you claimed you could do is you could, at the top of every show, you could give us five things about whatever year it is. So here you go. Five things about 1997.
That I haven't already blurted out?
You can expand on any of those if
you'd
like. I
would say it was the last season of Ryan Sandberg as a Chicago Cub and as a Major League Baseball player. And it was all the fact number one. Fact number two, it was also Harry Carey's final season as a Cubs broadcaster. Fun fact number three, I'm going to stay on the broadcasting part because you'll find this funny. It was supposed to have been a very rewarding year for one Josh Lewin, but a do not go quietly into the night raging old Harry Carey, one year from death's door, insisted on traveling down to Florida and doing the road games as well, just bumping Josh Lewin. So enough of that. I'm sure we can return to that if we want to. Also in 1997, I mentioned that Kevin Tapany was a Cub, but the better news is that the Cubs got the two best years out of Jaime Navarro's career in 1995 and 1996 and flipped him to the Sox from whence Tapany came. And he proceeded to be such a bust that Jerry Reinsdorf swore he would never allow his general managers to sign a free agent pitcher for more than 3 years. Fact number five, 1997 Cubs, having already mentioned they lost their first 14 games, I guess things were made particularly worse early in that losing streak when one of their few bright spots in his prime, Mark Grace, pulled his hamstring in Atlanta or possibly Florida, one of those two. It was a long, long April in 1997.
What year
was my five fact.
What year did Jaime Navarro fall down the stairs in the dugout?
He was only with the Cubs for 2 years, and he was damn good. Navarro won 17 games in 1992 for the Brewers, kind of like burst out of nowhere. And it was Paul Molitor's last year in Milwaukee, and they made some sort of unlikely pennant run, and, you know, hooray, hurrah. But then Jaime Navarro the next couple of years, absolutely. I don't know if he ate himself out of the league or what, but he was given a second chance by the Cubs, and he actually performed well for, you know, what he, you know, he wasn't commanding a high salary and built himself back up again. Like I said, after those 2 years, the Cubs may have traded for him. I don't think they signed him. He earned a really big contract. That's the only pitch for the Cubs, and he ended up getting stuck on the Sox. But as far as the stairwell goes, I couldn't help you there. You find anything online? Jaime Navarro falling down a well?
No, he wasn't. What's the little girl in Texas? The guy trapped
McClure, Jessica McClure. I mean, that was satirized on a Simpsons episode that took place 30 years.
Her dad used to pitch for the Brewers. That was Bob McClure, Bob. Right? Bob. All ties into baseball.
Sure does. Sure
now,
does.
You remember, of course, who the Cubs closer to start 1997.
I do. Big free agent signing, right?
Yes.
Felipe Alou's nephew, I believe. The one and only Mel Rojas.
Mel Rojas, yes. The cousin of Moises, the nephew of Felipe, Jesus, and Manny.
Oh, that's right. He would be Moises' cousin if he was Felipe. Okay. Wow. Yeah. And he was a free agent signing. They didn't have a whole lot of big signings in that era. You know, which was sort of like the second Tribune era where they were just sort of focused on mediocrity by design, where, you know, they could be competitive, and if a couple things go right, well, they might get in the playoffs, as evidenced by what happened the following year. But then, on the other hand, things can go wrong, and you have what we have in 97. So, yeah.
Yeah, Mel was a huge free agent pickup.
Yeah, they didn't do a lot of those.
He had been an excellent closer for the Expos. And so the Cubs are like, well, this is going to work. And his last year with the Expos, 1996. Why is this thing moving on me? Going to be a lot of me looking stuff up, folks. So get used to this, as if you're not very used to it. Where's the saves? Jesus Christ. 36 saves for the 96 Expos.
Okay.
But that was only, see, he had been John Wetland's setup man, right? So he
until
was only
Wetland
a full-time closer
for
two seasons, yeah, 95 yeah. and 96. And he had 66 saves in those 2 years. Came
pitching
to the Cubs. And
Tio Felipe.
He almost made it a full season with the Cubs.
The whole thing, first of all, Mel Rojas' awful season actually had little to do with the Cubs' season opening 14-game losing streak.
Yeah, they never had a lead. He couldn't blow one.
I don't think he did blow one. They were – and not that this is an excuse, because any team, you know, should not be this unprepared for the season. They opened up the season in Florida, who had purchased a pennant contender and would go to the World Series that year and win the World Series. With Atlanta, whom Florida would knock out on their way to the series, two best teams in the National League, and they played three at Florida. I think either two or three in Atlanta. One may have gotten rained out. I can't recall. Come home for opening day. Three more at Florida. and then home, two or three more with Atlanta. So you didn't expect them to get off to a great start, but you also didn't expect them to go, I think it was 0-10.
I distinctly remember looking at that schedule, and they were going to play their first 10 games against the Marlins and the Braves, and thinking, ugh, maybe they can win three. And thinking, if you start 3-7, you can get out from under that. That was wildly optimistic for me.
It was.
The thing about it, though, was, well, I guess not. The first two games they lost 4-2 and 4-3. Actually, how about this? Here are the winning pitchers in those 10 games. Kevin Brown.
Al Leiter.
Alex Fernandez. Are you looking at it?
No, I'm not. I'm not looking at it. I can remember that.
Oh, shit. Now, yes, you got all three of those right. Now, if you get this one right, I'll give you $1 million.
Was it Kevin Millwood or Denny Nagel?
It was Brad Klontz.
Okay, so he won in relief. So they pissed one game away. That could have been a Mower Hospital.
They lost 5-4 to the Barves to go over.
And then they probably lost to the Barves number 5 starter before running right into Maddox or Glavin, I'm guessing, at the end of that Atlanta leg. But did they play 3 in Atlanta? I believe they did, right?
They played 3 in Atlanta, and their last two starters were a couple of guys that nobody – I don't know what happened to either of these guys, John Smoltz and Greg Maddox.
Did the Braves have to, go to the 4-man rotation that early? obviously they had to get off days. I know. And you'd be dumb not to. It's just, all right. So they face Kevin Brown, Al Leiter, Alex Fernandez, who was still very good. I think he had just signed a free agent deal, and he was in his prime. And then, of course, Hall of Famers. And Kevin Brown is probably an arguable Hall of Famer, but Maddox and Glavin are. And then what happens? They come home to face Florida. They might avoid Brown and Leiter, but not both of them, I'm guessing.
Just one. They got Leiter, and they got Alex Fernandez again, and they lost.
Oh, they still got it.
They lost 5-3, and Frank Castillo lost to Alex Fernandez 1-0.
I remember that game, and I can tell you some details. The Cubs were being no hit in that game into the ninth inning. And this is just, I wonder if you could find this in 2021. It's such an otherwise insignificant game, but I was at work. Working for my boss Jimmy, who owned the company, he's a big Cubs fan, so it was okay that we're in the back watching this game on a black and white TV, trying to get the signal. Cubs are about to go 0-9. They're losing 1-0, and Fernandez, in his return to Chicago, because he'd been a White Sox pitcher for 5 years, pitched in the playoffs for him, takes a no-hitter. I'm sure it was in the ninth, and I don't remember all the players involved. Jose Hernandez was one of them, because I remember at some point what happened was no-hitter got broken up, and then somebody laid down a bunt that Fernandez misplayed, but then Jose Hernandez circled third base too far, and he got picked off. So they go from, oh, we're going to be 0-9 and no hit. Oh, no hitter's over. Oh, we might finally win a game. And then, no, you can't run the bases. You're out. And that made it 0-9. And then here comes Atlanta again.
Well, in that, let's pause for a second. So in that 1-0 loss, this is quite a box score. For the Marlins, one run on 7 hits and 4 errors. For the Cubs, no runs on 1 hit. All he got was 1 goddamn hit and no errors.
Yes.
The errors were on Edgar Renteria. Oh, wait. I'm looking at the wrong thing. The errors were on Greg Zaun, 2 on Edgar Renteria, and ace third baseman, Bobby Bonilla.
Jeff Conine? Bobby Bonilla was their third baseman.
Conine was playing first.
Okay. So they're like, here, we feel bad for you. Just win a game. And no, that's okay. We're going to let you tag us out as we round the bases.
So the ninth inning against Alex went the route. So the ninth inning, Dave Clark struck out swinging.
Dave Clark 5.
Dave Hansen, single to the pitcher. Jose pinch ran for Dave Hansen. That's how he got on.
Okay, that's what it was.
Brian McKay reached on Bonilla's error. Hernandez the second. Then Brant Brown, a year before, all of his heroics, and then his identity, all in the same year.
And but a year after, he had a 2-homer game when he came up in 96.
He reached on a ground ball. He reached on an error to Renteria. And then you don't see this much. It says 6-5. Brown to first, McRae to second, Hernandez out at third base slash shortstop.
Yeah, I mean, because it wasn't a force out. It's 6-5 was the scoring, right? Shortstop to third baseman, I'm assuming. So Renteria doesn't make the play.
It looks like it went. Looks like it went Bonilla to Renteria back to Bonilla. The old 5-6-5, which you see all the time.
I'd have to look at a video now.
Ryan Sandberg.
Oh, yeah, who, you know, probably shouldn't have come back. Yeah, so 0-9. And they now used to, but guess what? You still got to face who now in Atlanta? Atlanta's coming it down.
Oh, well, you know, at 0-9, or actually, Fernandez made him 0-8. The ninth game was the Braves' fifth starter. And who was that? A former Cub.
A future Cub or a former Cub?
He had already been a Cub
before he went to Atlanta. Oh, my gosh. And it wasn't Greg Maddux.
His nickname was the Style Master.
Oh, my God. I'm not the Style Master? Now I really feel bad.
He pitched the best game of the 1989 playoffs.
Oh, Mike Bielecki.
Mike Bielecki.
1990 opening day starter, Mike Bielecki.
He outdueled, I don't know who started, but Bob Patterson took the loss in relief, 2-1. So here are some of the scores in this ignominious start. 4-2, 4-3, 5-4, 5-3, 1-0, 2-1.
Yeah.
The next game, 0-10, the winner. You know things are going bad. You're 0-10, and two of the losses are to Brad Klontz.
Wow.
Turk Wendell took the loss in number 10.
Turk, who would ultimately become the closer, I believe, when Rojas lost the job. So I can tell you that I went to the Saturday game, and that I was just full of rage at the end and alcohol, and just trying to get everybody in the bleachers to – you know, I don't know, burn Ed Lynch in effigy. I was done. I'm like, how can this keep going on? It was cold. It was Kenny Lofton was a Brave. I remember trying to heckle him and, you know, just, you know, I'm 25. I'm living in the city. I was supposed to, you know, it's supposed to not be like this. And I'm just going to the game and just getting absolutely annoyed. And just painful, painful. And I think the Sunday game was rained out. So, mercifully. So they lose Friday and Saturday. I think, did Glavin pitch on the Saturday?
It looks like they didn't play on Friday. Must have got rained out because they played Thursday. Saturday. Then they only played Saturday, Sunday, unless they had.
Yes.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. They wouldn't have a day.
They were scheduled for 12 games, and there was one rain out. I couldn't remember if it was in Atlanta or Wrigley. Was it Wrigley? They got all three in Atlanta, got swept.
So then mercifully. You're done with the Braves.
Here come the Rockies, right?
Here come the Rockies, who are about to have their first winning season ever.
I can tell you something so insignificant, but I remember with enough detail to share that I was going on my lunch break or something from work and listening to the game, Virgil Patrick Hughes, and Mark Grace was alongside of him because, as I said, Grace had pulled his hamstring on the opening season road trip. So they don't even have Grace. He joins Pat in the booth. Well, Mark, maybe you can bring us some good luck today. And what I remember listening to was, you're going to have to pull up the Colorado. It's the next game. It was a day game because they still would often play multiple day games in a series. But they had some sort of a blunder that was even worse than Jose Hernandez rounding third and getting picked off. And I can't remember if it was on – I think it was like a missed squeeze bunt or something. It was just like – it just kept getting worse. Like there's no bottom. And for the – now I thought I could recall exactly what it was. And like you know, Pat Hughes is usually a pretty good propaganda minister. You know, he's pretty good about putting lipstick on a pig and really not letting you know how awful it is and doing his best to be sad and not angry. I think Grace was getting annoyed himself. It was just, you know, it's like at this point, it's like the season's just about over, you know?
So in this, this Tuesday game, the 10-7 loss, this will give you a window into just how bad this team was. Here's the batting. This is the starting lineup. Brian McRae leading off in center. Brant Brown, batting second and playing first base. God love him. Maybe my favorite Cub of all time. Sean Dunston is batting third. The fourth place hitter is Samuel Peralta Sosa.
The one, even he was having a rough year himself, but he was the only real player.
But listen to this juggernaut, 5-6-7. Brooks Kieschnick.
Yes.
Kevin Ory and Scott Service.
Hey, man. It wasn't long after that, Andy, where Brooks Kieschnick had a two-homer game. So you might want to step off.
He had six total bases in this game, double and
he did.
Yes,
and yet, so they were already because I don't think well Kieschnick may have been on the
here's
team
the,
opening.
Here's
game.
The just the bad the batting averages of the eight guys starting the game for the Cubs.
And of course, these are batting averages at this point in the season,
yes,
right? That you're reading the box score.
146, 154, 167. No, I'm sorry, I skipped. I threw Tyler Houston in there. He pinch hit for Brant Brown. He was hitting a robust 167 off the bench.
Uh-huh.
Sean was hitting 128. Sammy, 179. Kieschnick, a red hot 250. Kevin Ory, 226. This might be as highest it ever was for him. Scott Service, 133. And he also had a slugging percentage of 133. And Jose Hernandez, the star of stars, had a slash line of 375, 444, 750. So, of course, he's batting eighth.
Of course. So, I did find, I pulled up the game because it was killing me exactly what kind of, like, dumb fuckery was going on the first inning. And you can kind of get a clue if you read the play-by-play in the top of the first, whereupon future Cub Eric Young flies out to lead the game. Quentin McCracken, no relation to Phil, to right. He gets on. Larry Walker's up. McCracken steals second, advances to third on the throw. All right, so he's at third. Larry Walker's still up, one out. Larry Walker, strikeout swinging, catcher to first base. McCracken scores. So I think that's what it was. It was just a drop third strike and a run score. So it just sort of, you know, it was emblematic of, it was Murphy's Law. I mean, you know, those lineups didn't help, but it was just, and it continued, didn't end with that homestand. So they go 0-6 on the road, and they come home and go 0-7. So. You know, they come home 0-6, right? You're like, oh, thank God they're home.
Yep.
Oh, come on, let's make some hay while the sun shines.
Time for some home cooking. Probably going to go 6-0 at home, be 500.
Right.
Head off to New York.
They're getting into a cab to go to O'Hare, and they're like, they still haven't won a goddamn game.
So, yeah, after being swept by the Rockies, they were a cool 0-12.
Oh, just 12. Is that it? Is that right? I'm sorry.
Yes.
I had it wrong, though.
0-12.
Okay.
Six on the road, six at home. And they were off to New York, where mercifully the Friday night game was rained out.
No. Oh, that's right. That's right.
So they got a much-needed day's rest, which meant that they could come back refreshed on Saturday and lose 6-3.
So they scheduled a doubleheader for Sunday. So yeah, I remember one time star.
It was Sunday, but it made sense because it was a wraparound series. They were already scheduled to stay through Monday, so Sunday was the ideal time to have the doubleheader.
I do recall listening to the Saturday game as I was driving through traffic in the city, and it was like the sort of the emergence of a fleeting star, Edgardo Alfonso. You might recall, pretty good player for a couple of years. I know he did some damage to him. I believe on the Saturday game. I could be wrong, but or Sun. I don't know. Maybe not. I'm not seeing him in that lineup. But another Cubs loss. 0-14.
So one of the most famous aspects in hindsight now of this terrible start, other than the fact that the Cubs were literally out of the pennant race before you had to turn in your taxes. It's just they really were. They were. How about this? On tax day, 6.5 games out of first already. But they would bump those numbers up by the 24th of April, 10.5 games out. Is that
so,
the fastest any team has ever been double digits out of first place?
We're gonna take this a little bit further because Yeah, because you brought up Mel Rojas. And so now we have to bring in that of all those games we covered, we didn't really go into detail in all of them, but none of us recall Rojas blowing any of those games, right? So finally, on the back end of a doubleheader, right, they lose the first game to actually go in 14, I believe, right? Yep. So now they play the second game. And, of course, they can't blow a team out. In fact, they're losing late. They're about to go in 15. They score a couple in the seventh. Or they weren't losing late. They score a couple in the sixth, go up 2-1. They get a couple more. They're kind of coasting, but, you know, you got to get that win in. So now, ninth inning, here comes Cubs, you know, highly prized free agent signing, Mel Rojas here to, you know, nail down the save and, you know, and turn things around for the Cubs. Mel Rojas proceeded to face one batter. Before, I don't even know. He got an out. He did get an out. Huh. And I see, yeah, he pulled a hamstring or something. It was like, oh, great. I mean, you know, I know he wasn't getting action, but, you know, I think he had a responsibility to maybe be in better shape than he was. I don't know. So, yeah, they got to hurry up Turk Wendell, who, you know, the oddball Turk, been on the team for a few years by now. Kind of a swing man. Comes in to nail down the save, but not before giving up two runs. I don't even remember if the bases were loaded. He faced six batters, so he comes in with one out. He faces six batters, meaning four of them he did not retire. So two scored, and he must have had two on base, just to make it interesting. And then, but the Cubs won the next day, so it's like, all right, 2-14. They come home, they lose two more to the Pirates, and I remember just going to a game, and they were 2-17. I'm like, what's worse? Is 0-14's bad, but you're 2-17. And that game, I think they blew it. Rojas finally did blow his first game. Young Jason Kendall had a big hit late and turned the game around. And yeah, I mean, it didn't matter. Like you said, by tax day, it's over, but it got a little bit worse. The one thing that does amaze me is that they didn't lose 100 games. I mean, you lose 17 out of your first 19. You know, how do you not start setting records? They only lost 94.
That was one of the amazing things about the century of Cub ineptness was I think they only lost 100 games three times.
Uh-huh. And not until the 60s, I think, or twice. I think they did it either once in the 60s, once in the 50s, and then in Theo's first year.
Yeah.
It happened.
That was all part of the master plan. Theo only lost games on purpose.
And it was. But like I said the term I used was and I'm gonna come back to it as we do future ones because it's just to give the context. But it was the Cubs were in the throes of what I call mediocrity by design, and that's evidenced by the fact that in spite of that awful start, they didn't lose 100 games. They weren't really awful. They just never stood a chance of being competitive for the longest time. And you know, and that sort of began about halfway through, or about a third of the way through Tribune's ownership, where they sort of shifted gears. And you know, like I said, from 1992 basically until they sold the team to Sam Zell, they were very sort of carefully calibrated to put a team out there that was, you know, on paper, you know, maybe okay. And if they got, like I said, if the ball bounces the right way, if you just look at the 90s, you know, they didn't get eliminated to the second to last day of the season in 95. They squeak into the wild card in 98. They go to the playoffs in 03 with only 88 wins. All right, so they had decent teams and things went right. But then when things go bad, you have seasons like 1997.
Yeah. Yes, in their long-storied history, they've never lost more than 103 games. And they've only lost 100 games three times, 1966, 1962, and 2012. So now, they've lost 90 games a lot. That's a long list.
At least 10 times.
But not 100. Right. The Cubs aren't going to bottom out on you. They're just going to be just going to be bad. They're not going to be true.
Yeah. Yeah. We've had one number one pick in the draft in the history of the amateur draft.
But he was the best one ever.
Yes, good old number 12.
Yes. Good old number 12. Good old, so I have a book here, so I have to have a bookmark, and the bookmark is, oh, look who it is.
Ah, there he is. Two-time All-Star, Two-time All-Star. And he was on the 97 Cubs.
Yes, he came back.
Kind of sad watching. He came back. So he'd already left. He left. You know, I always, when I think about Sean Dunstan, and I, you know, you joke around. I know you really did like him, you know. But I think I can speak honestly when I say that as someone that was, you know, really the arc of his entire career really sort of came within my observational wheelhouse, being as I was, you know, a rather sports obsessed 13-year-old, you know, through most of his career. And I would say he was a good player, he had a nice career, but for Cubs fans, he was, you know, ultimately kind of a disappointment. He was the first pick in the draft out of Brooklyn. He didn't go to college, so it took him a while to come up, and he got called up kind of early. In 1985,
yeah, he got called up because Larry Boa was up.
Well, you know, Larry Boa was. You know, Larry Boa was 39 years old in 1985. I never knew that in 1984 the Cubs actually had a 38-year-old shortstop.
Who he was played like
4 foot three. Well, I know, but they won 96 games.
Larry Boa was terrible.
Well, I'm not going to defend Larry Boa.
If you're the Cubs and you know Larry Boa was terrible, and you have, couldn't you have found a stopgap shortstop so you didn't have to rush?
They tried Tom Verizer in 84. Yeah,
he wore the same – Fry liked him because they wore the same glasses. Oh.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, he was an old Tiger too. I suppose Fry may have remembered him from that. But so –
all right, here's Larry Boa. Larry Boa in 1984. He hit .223, but at least he got on base. .274. Oh, wait. Sorry. But at least he slugged. .269. He played 133 games, and his slugging was lower than his on-base one.
Carlos Zambrano probably had higher OPSs in some seasons than he did.
He didn't strike out, though. Although, lot of times he wished he would. Also, didn't ground into double plays. He must have popped up all the time.
I don't want to talk about Larry Boa game that happened in 1985, where he actually won on a suicide bunt with two strikes after falling off five
pitches.
That's
fine. That's the one thing he could do was bunt.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure, and when we get to the 80s, we'll have plenty of time to talk about this. One of my favorite memories about Larry was in 85, he started wearing glasses. And I distinctly remember Harry saying, well, he's got glasses now. The ball must look like a beach ball to him. Found out he couldn't hit a beach ball either. Didn't matter.
So, yeah, they didn't have a stopgap. That was one mistake. I'll speak highly of Dallas Green throughout the next 30 some odd podcast, because it's one of the underpinnings of how I view this time. But they did, I think, that, and you know, I don't want to put all the blame on the
Cubs.
Couldn't
they have traded for what was the game? Shoot. When I was a kid, you know, you could see the Cubs and the Braves because of the superstations.
Gladmother Hubbard? No, he was a second baseman. Oh, Rafael
Ramirez. Rafael Ramirez. That was I always liked him. Like, oh, they should get Rafael Ramirez.
I was more of a Gerald Perry fan myself.
Yeah, who wasn't?
Not really. So Dunstan, you know, he was a two-time All-Star at one point, and legitimately, maybe a little bit overhyped, but he was sort of neck and neck with Barry Larkin as like the premier shortstop. And he never learned to hit a curveball.
Are you going to go with the flimsy argument that Barry Larkin was a better shortstop than Sean Dunstan just because Barry Larkin is a Hall of Famer? And Sean
just
isn't.
Going on.
Is that going to be your argument, Mr. Smart Guy? That just because one guy goes to the Hall of Fame and the other guy doesn't, that the guy who goes to the Hall of Fame is better? Well, whatever.
In all seriousness, I do, right. Well, I do point that out only because Larkin, of course, was a Hall of Famer. But at one point, I think when the comparisons were being made, in my heart, I knew Larkin was a better player. But I was like, yeah, let's hype up Sean. So, yeah, he was an All-Star, I want to say, in 88 and 90. But he never really took the next level as a hitter. He couldn't cut down on laying off the goddamn breaking ball in the dirt with two strikes. And then injuries took a toll. I mean, he was an exciting player, so he did provide intangibles. One of my favorite moments with Dunstan was he missed like a year and a half. He was in their opening day lineup in 91 or 92, and then he got hurt, missed all of 92 and missed all of 93, and they're out of it. And he comes back for a game, and you know, he's older now, right? So he's like, you know, he's still only 29 or 30, but he was already, I think the injury is almost like not like Gale Sayers, but he was already losing his effectiveness in that department. But in a late meaningless game in September, he somehow came all the way around from first on just a couple of pitches and like scored the winning run. He was just trying to get his legs out from under him, and Harry was excited. It was a really cool moment. Like, man, that's, you know, but you're already almost feeling sad. He was only 29 or 30. And he, you know, he kept kind of getting injured. He stayed with the Cubs 295, left, went to the Giants, and so on the 1997 version, he had come back. And by then, he was just a different type of a player, right? He proved to have some value as a journeyman, I think, as an older player. I mean, he hit a homer in the World Series for the Giants.
His last at bat in baseball should have been a home run that won the World Series.
But Dusty fucked him. He left the guy in or pulled him out? Pulled him out, Russ Ortiz?
He took Russ Ortiz out and let him have the ball. Remember that? Gave him the game ball on the mound.
Yes, yes. And then he did the opposite thing with the Cubs by leaving a guy.
Right, that's why he wouldn't take Mark Pryor out. He's like, I'm not doing that again. It's like, all right, this is not how this works. It's not like, oh, I fucked that up last time. I'm going to do the exact opposite. That'll work. No, the situations aren't the same. Anyway, you know, I got plenty of time to pick on Dusty. Here's one thing I don't get. So supposedly, who's the last guy to hit 400 in the major leagues?
Supposedly, well, Ted Williams, obviously,
right? It's not, because it says right here in black and white, in 1993, Sean Dunstan hit 400 on the nose. I know it was only 10 at bats.
He went 4 for 10, yeah.
He hit 315 in 1992. Of course, that was only 73 at bats, but still.
Yeah.
Do you remember how he hurt himself?
No, but it had to be serious. I was a little bit detached from the
club. He needed back surgery. He hurt himself. Now, this is ironic. He was taking future major leaguer Sean Dunstan Jr.'s car seat out of the car, and he threw out his back, and he ruptured a disc and had to have back surgery.
Wow.
And that was basically the end of his full-time productivity.
It really was. That was it. He was never the same player.
But he was. He fancied a pretty long career as a utility player.
He played
some center field for the Indians.
And I remember my dad saying, "Long in the 80s.
He spent two stints.
Why don't they put him in center?
Huh?
My dad used to say it in the 80s, Dunstan in center.
Oh, my dad just wanted to pitch. You see the Anthony Ghost, the Blue Jay, he was an outfielder with this incredible arm, couldn't hit. And
never heard him.
He's now in their bullpen, and he throws like 98 miles an hour. Yeah. Everybody told him all the time, you should pitch. He's like, I don't want to pitch. And then when they realized he was about to be kicked out of baseball because he couldn't hit.
Yeah. Yeah. Look
at him. He's good. He's a legitimately good relief pitcher.
Holy cow. I didn't even know about him. Wow.
So that's a pretty good segue to, we've mentioned him already. But the left fielder on that Cub team, he didn't get the most at-bats in left field.
Okay, well, it would be a troika of, let's see, Brooks Kieschnick, maybe throw in a little Robin Jennings. Was he a 97 Cub?
And, he was. All the stars we heard about all the time. Terrell Lowry.
Oh, good old Terrell Lowry.
Robin Jennings. The guy who got the most games in left field, Doug Glanville.
Oh, okay. I liked Glanville.
He hit 300.
He did hit 300.
474 at bats, so he legitimately hit 300.
And then the Cubs traded him for Mickey Morandini, and I was upset until Morandini had a nice season.
The dandy little glove man.
He was. I had forgotten Doug Glanville was one of the few bright. He was actually, I would consider, the bright spot. He had a decent career, and almost helped the Cubs clinch a pennant in his old age. Like, you know, he came back like Sean Dunstan.
Yeah, but Brooks Kieschnick, who the Cubs drafted to much fanfare. He was a power hitting outfielder and closer for the University of Texas.
Yep.
And all the smart teams had him as a first round grade on him as a pitcher. And
except
the Cubs had
guys.
One on him as an outfielder. And he did they retarded his growth. He was relatively productive for a few years with the Brewers, being a relief pitcher and a pinch hitter.
Later on.
But that's a tricky thing, because you've got him in the bullpen, and then also you need a pinch hit, and, you know,
They literally have to stop the game, and he runs through the outfield to get
like,
to the dugout.
Like Todd Coffey of the Reds, you remember that weirdo that would sprint to the mound out of the bullpen? So I have to own up to I took a shot at the White Sox, which I will do almost just sort of reflexively throughout the course of these podcasts. But yeah, I sort of derive some schadenfreude out of the fact that the Cubs got the best years out of Kevin Tappany and Jaime Navarro while flipping Navarro back to the Sox. Well, it always embittered me that Larry Himes, in four successive drafts as general manager of the White Sox, selected Jack McDowell, Robin Ventura, Frank Thomas, and the aforementioned Alex Fernandez. And then he comes to the Cubs and he drafts Brooks Kieschnick.
Well, because we found out that the Cubs were taking the guy he really wanted, and he's had to settle for those guys.
I really wanted
Ty Griffin. I'll have to sell for Robin Ventura. Oh, I really wanted Earl Cunningham.
Right.
I guess I'll have to sell for Frank Thomas.
He was just pantsing Jim Fry. Is that what you're saying? Lance Dixon. Yeah, they probably had intelligence on Dixon's arm and didn't tell, you know.
I remember my dad being very mad when the Cubs took Ty Griffin
in 88.
Simply because ESPN show in the College World Series. And Robin Ventura has like a 70-game hitting streak. Some ridiculous...
71 games, I want to
and
say.
And the Cubs had had this gaping hole at third base since Ron Santo had left. Except for the 2 years of Bill Madlock, but...
Correct. Yeah, you can say Madlock.
No, he was legitimately great. And then P.K. Wrigley didn't like who...
we know.
Didn't
right.
like who Bill was dating.
Of course, and that's true. But I'm just... Right, I know. All the more reason to draw the line at Madlock and not Santo, especially because he came right after Santo. But anyway,
since Madlock, they had this nothing, this big wad of nothing, with a couple years of tiny little Ron Say waddling around.
Yes, yes.
One of which Vance was good. One of which was good. Eight.
You're forgetting the all-star third baseman in 1988.
Yes,
my
Vance Law had a good 2 months in 1988. Somehow got him on the all-star team, and then...
Whitey Herzog put him on the team.
By mid-1989, they were having to trade for a then binocular-visioned Luis Salazar.
Luis Salazar, yep.
But yeah, it's like, that's the guy. You need that guy. And then for years, we watched Robin be very good.
So I never actually... I had never crossed paths with that thought, and I'm glad, because it would have taken some years off my life in my younger years, especially after Ventura really established himself with the Sox. So it's a fact that Ty Griffin was drafted ahead of Robin Ventura? Is that a fact?
I believe...
I'm going to assume it is.
No,
your dad
I believe...
Not...
Yes, the Cubs could have had Robin. They took Ty.
Thank you. And so Ty Griffin was an outfielder.
Second base.
No, he couldn't have been a second baseman.
That was the other thing that stupefied everyone.
Wait a second. I thought for years Todd Walker was the only player drafted as a second. Because all second basemen, I assumed, were drafted as shortstops. There's no way. I don't think so. I don't think...
He played second base at the Georgia Institute of Technology, better known as Georgia Tech.
Georgia Tech?
So it's not like he was hidden.
That's horrible.
He was the ninth pick.
Shortstop? What are you...
Yeah, no, it didn't make any sense. It made none. Guess how many picks he got taken ahead of Robin Ventura? This is going to make it even...
I don't even want... I'm already furious that I never knew he was drafted as a goddamn second baseman.
One.
Just one. Yeah. Sox are right behind
Quite
the Cubs.
Andy Bennis went number one. Steve Avery went number three. Greg,
good draft.
Greg with 2G, the catcher.
Olson. Yeah.
Jim Abbott went right before Ty Griffin.
Hey, he had a nice career, another Big Ten player.
He did. Drafted after those guys. Tino Martinez, Royce Clayton.
Wow, that's a pretty productive
Rico
draft.
Rico Gronia, Ed Sprague, Alex Fernandez.
Fernandez got picked
by the Brewers, didn't sign.
Baseball Almanac has the information. He was drafted as a second baseman.
Brian
I'm just renewing my hatred.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Those are still good names.
Brian Jordan is a great two-way player.
It's
just I am so renewing my hatred, my anger towards
the deceased
Jim Fry. Well, they pointed out after he busted out, and maybe could have predicted, well, you know, he had an aluminum bat in college. He never adjusted to wood. I don't know if that was a thing or not.
That was actually part of the knock on Robin. Mm. But so then the guy they take is also a college player who used Looney.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it wasn't that. It was that he just sucked and they overscouted him. Wow. All right. We're going to have a lot to say over the intervening months about Jim Fry and, you know, Dallas Green. And let's just say, just to give you the Cliff Notes version for now, we'll go into a deeper dive. Big fan of Dallas Green. But Jim Fry really set the franchise back when he was our general manager. And I've unearthed something tonight that I did not previously know that only further cements that. So
I was going to say, one of the things that the 97 season became famous for in hindsight was Dave Kaplan was on Sports Central with
I used to listen to it.
That would have been Tommy Waddle. Tommy Waddle was there in 97.
97? Was he already working? Usually I thought the ball players took a couple of years off before they jumped back into the fray. Okay.
He needed a job. He was an undrafted part-time wide receiver.
He didn't want to waste that Q factor.
He was probably bagging groceries at the Jewels.
Okay.
Made a bet after when they were like 0-5. That he would go sleep in the WGN van across from Wrigley.
I remember that. I remember that now.
Until the Cubs won a game. And then they just kept losing and losing. I'm sure the 1-0 game made his little ball. He had hair.
Wait, I'm sure his
hair fall out of his head.
I'm sure you could reach out to Cap and ask if he remembers the details, but I'm going to assume.
Oh, I can do better than that.
Go ahead.
I'll just link to this. On Discipio, there is a fake oral history of the 97 Cubs, but.
Yes.
All the Dave Kaplan quotes are real, and he tells the story.
Got it. Because I'm just going to surmise that it was a opening day stunt because they came home 0-6.
Oh, it probably
so
was.
That's
and he says in the thing, he said, I thought maybe they'd lose a game or two. I'd spend a couple nights in the van. Ha, ha, ha.
That just, now
and
I'm
the
laughing.
Rainout apparently almost drove him, like, he was starting to lose it.
And he still has.
Okay, they're playing the Mets. Mets aren't they good? They're going
to
win. And then he watches it rain. Well, and now they're not going to play. Okay. He's got another day in the van.
Well, you know, there were two rainouts, which, you know, but what's worse? A rainout's got to be worse because in your head, if you're an optimist, you assume they're going to win. But they had the rainout at Wrigley the Friday against the Braves, and then another rainout the following Friday on the road against the Mets. So, yeah, I think a rainout will drive you crazy because you're inclined to think that that's the day it's going to end. However, a loss when you're hoping that that's the day it's going to end, and it doesn't, I don't think there are any good choices there. So I'm at least now laughing instead of like, you know, I'm just the thought now of the Cubs getting into that cab to the airport. Well, like at the end of that road trip and Dave Kaplan's still stuck in his camper.
All right. So here are some oddities about the 97 Cubs. So they finished 68-94. Now you're familiar obviously with the Pythagorean win loss record is.
Mm-hmm.
You take the runs you score and the runs you allow, and then the other axis,
right,
is miraculously
an inexact simple formula to basically
how many games you
should
have won. So they underachieved by 6 games according to Pythagoras. Okay. They should have been 74-88, which is bad, but it's
which
not
was, which
terrible.
Is how the Tribune management in those days drew it up. Mediocrity
right.
by design.
But this blew me away when I just looked this up. What do you think their home record was?
You know what? I'm going to say it's a winning record because I went to a lot of games and they somehow won. They lost a lot of games, too. I went to a lot of games. I was 25 and it was my first year of season tickets.
They were go ahead.
Well, I'm going to say I'm going to say 44 and 37?
Well, they were 42 and 39.
But okay.
They outscored their opponents by more than 40 runs.
Okay.
Home. On the road, not so good. 26 and 55 and got outscored by 102. A 321 winning percentage on the road. Do you think they had a winning month?
I would almost think they would have to have had one to finish with only 94 losses after starting 2-17.
They had two.
Okay.
May, wow. They were 15-13, and they got hot in September and went 13-12. All right, maybe not that
hot. Wow. Wow. cherry on top
June
of the
June and July were a little rough, where they went a combined 22-34. They were 11-17 in both
but
months.
Even that is not horrible.
That was, year three of interleague play?
They dominated. Year one. No.
That's right, 97 ones. I went to a game this year. I saw him play the Brewers.
Well, you ruined my trivia question for you, but you already knew it. Oh. Who was their first interleague opponent?
Right. Division rival.
Kids today. Well, it's been so long ago. That was the only year, right? The Brewers joined in time for Brant Brown to drop a ball the next season. Yep. So, yeah.
Yeah, interleague play, they were 9-6.
Yeah. The day that the Chicago Bulls won title number 5 over Utah, the first victory over Utah, that was the one time that I decided to go down to Grant Park, went with a buddy, and it was the same day as what would become the first Cubs Sox game. Hmm. It was like my most Chicago day ever, because we watched this rally, and my buddy and I went down to the Billy Goat underneath Michigan Avenue. I had actually never been there before. Had a burger, a few beers, jumped on the red line, and the Cubs and Sox actually played a day game to kick all that off, you might remember. Brian McRae started things off with a double down the line.
Cubs had to wear those ridiculous old navy blue uniforms that looked like they were 4,000 degrees in.
That's right. But yeah, Cubs beat them. Cubs actually lost the next two, you know, and then back then, the first 2 years of interleague play, they did a home and home. They only played one series, and Uncle Jerry was like, no, I would really like to have that Wrigley Field revenue every year. Exactly. So we're going
to
do
the only reason that you still have to play your rival twice is because of Jerry Reinsdorf.
Is that true, really, across the other, like, New York don't really care. It's a different scenario for them in L.A. Yeah, well, I don't think in either of those cities you would have had such a disparity, I think.
So this is interesting. So in one-run games, they were pretty good. They were 24-26. In blowouts, they were 19-20. So it was every game in between that they were terrible in.
Uh-huh. So it's like a game that you're
playing. If you kept it real close... You had a little better chance to beat them. If it was 5 runs or more, they were going to be in it. But anything from 2 runs to 4, you were going to beat the Cubs every time.
Yeah. Well, I kind of imagine it like close games, and then like a team just always gets that back-breaking 6th and 7th inning run. I'm sure there's a whole variety. I'm sure there wasn't one way. I just in my mind, because this is what we're doing here, and we're trying to keep it on 1997 as much as we can. But I have a memory of a Mel Rojas blowout, because so far my only negative Mel Rojas. Well, no, I did mention that he blew the save of the game that I was at that made him 2-17. But other than that, we only mentioned that he was too fat to finish an inning and couldn't get a save. I remember I just got my first computer. Right, it was early days of AOL, right? And I had it in my kitchen. I was single, I had a roommate, but I was in the kitchen. I had a TV in the kitchen, and I'm on the line. I'm looking over my shoulder, and I think they had a 2-run lead in the 9th, and Rojas came in. This was in Philadelphia, so it was sometime in early May. Just watching the game. Harry's on the play-by-play, and I just remember Rojas just giving up an absolute bomb to Lieberthal, Philly catcher.
Yes, there was – If the Cubs had won, as terrible as they had been, they were going to pull within 6 games of first place with plenty of season left.
Are you for sure?
Yes,
you're right. Holy crap! I'm looking at it now.
I remember
they were 5. They were actually 5 out after.
Okay,
that.
They could have pulled within 4. You're legitimately in it, no matter what your record is. If you're only 4 games out of first.
Oh man, that was. So there's a reason I remember it. It was soul crushing because going into the game, the Cubs were 24-33, 9 under, not great. All right, Phillies are 20-37, so they weren't even that good anyway. So they're 9 under, but they were, as we established, at 1 point 2-17.
All right, so what's the date on that game?
The date on that game is June 5th, 1997.
Because I was going to say, if you were in 1997, if you were watching the game and you were on your computer. Had it been July 24th or later, could have been on Discipio.com.
Oh!
It actually wasn't Discipio yet.
Wow.
It was Balls.
Wait, right. And you've mentioned that before.
But I couldn't get Balls.com. Somebody owned it and wanted me to pay like $10,000 for it. So I'm like, I'm not going to do that. So I came up with Discipio instead.
I don't got porn money.
That's right.
Balls.com.
Balls.com.
So wait. So at your earliest Enterprise, Andy, was actually this season, right? 1997?
Yes. Oh, I mean, think about it. Why wouldn't you be all excited to start writing about sports when the Cubs start 0-14?
Right. And we talked about this on a Bears cast. The Bears also started 0-7. Mm-hmm. And I had an inkling, and I looked it up. And I remember the Hawks. I know that, you know, you're not, you know, writing about the Hawks as much as the other ones. But they also, like, did not – they got points, but they didn't get an actual win in, like, their first 14 games.
But, you know
– if wasn't for the Bulls winning at all, that would have been easily the worst season in Chicago sports. Right.
The Bulls won the championship for the final time in May. 97-98.
Yes, that's right. You got to cover that.
Yep.
Yeah.
They had just won number 5 a month before I started, and they won number 6.
Yes. Yes. And then
And I was writing about basketball. Actually, I was writing for onhoops.com.
That's right.
And Discipio was simply me, like, learning how to build a website. And then I just started to put other – so, like, my basketball stuff went down hoops. I started writing about the other stuff on Discipio. So
Got it. All the other crazy shit in your head.
All right, so now one of the things we should do every time we do one of these is zip through the roster at some of the ridiculous names that pop out.
Let me pull one up. Go ahead.
This would have been our first glimpse at – the dumbest player in baseball history, Manny Alexander. I mean, Ronnie Cedeno is pretty close, but I think Manny, just looking at him, dumber. Ronnie looked like a guy who you could confuse. You couldn't confuse Manny because he was too dumb to be confused.
Well, okay, both have incidences that we can maybe explore. I don't know if it's scientific to really gauge.
Ronnie's the only guy I've ever seen who got thrown out stealing a base on a walk.
But here's what makes him stupid. Because, and just to describe what happened.
He did it against Yadi Molina, and Yadi's going to get you.
It was against the Cardinals. Was it early in two? I'm not even sure of the year now. Damn it. Again, maybe we shouldn't go over it and save it till we pull up that year, but we might not remember it.
I'm sure we'll have a whole Ronnie Cedeno podcast.
But he attempted to steal second on what was ball 4, although it was a close pitch, but the ump called it a ball. The throw went down because it was so close. The catcher didn't want to risk it. And Cedeno slid and then slid past the bag. Yes,
he overslid the bag.
Right. He overslid. But then, here's the thing is that happens. But then here's what clinched it for me is after the game, he was asked about, you know, the fact it was ball 4, and he said, "Well, I don't know. I guess they changed the rules."
So what's Manny's? Is it being caught with a towel and $10,000 in it of Sammy Sosa's money in the lobby of a hotel in the Dominican Republic?
Yeah, but you know what? Manny shut the hell up, right?
He did,
didn't he? He took the fall, basically.
He did.
Right?
Yes, and then he also he went to Boston.
Okay.
And he was peripherally on the edges of their steroid stuff, too.
Got it. Okay. So
I think he's just
Manny's
a steroid
sort of
mule.
Side hustle.
I think that's what Manny's real job.
That was his side hustle. Yep. He was like, you know, I don't know how long a career I'm going to have. I'm built like a fire hydrant. I look like a troll.
He's a slightly more handsome Jose Macias.
Yes. The gremlin.
Maybe the worst looking player ever.
And, you know, I don't think I should probably clarify a gremlin after it. What is it fed after midnight or water? What
and
makes
it,
them?
Well, he was the one that blew up in the microwave.
Yes.
That's what
the one in particular. Yes. So, okay. So Manny Alexander, 97 Cub. Good to know. Who else you got?
How about Kent Battenfield?
Oh, good old Kenny.
This was his second year with the Cubs.
Which, you know, going into those ones where you sort of laugh when a guy does well for you and does horrible for another team, Amy Navarro, but it hurts when it happens the other way. It's totally true for Kent Battenfield because he was sort of a back end like swingman. He didn't really stand out at all. And then somehow, I think we know how.
Yeah.
He ends up in St. Louis and he's an all-star for the Cardinals.
That was his sixth year. 19, and he was with the Cardinals in 98, but in 99 was his big year. 99 was his sixth season in the big leagues. He had 17 career wins going into that season. He went 18-7.
He had 17 cumulatively throughout the course of his career.
And then after that season, he won a grand total of 10.
In his career?
Yeah.
He's 46, so it's just 49. 18 of them came in 1 year for the Cardinals.
So it was just 1 year. Okay.
And he was an all-star.
So I don't feel that bad. I'd feel more annoyed.
No Bob Tewksbury.
Yeah, that's a good call. Tewksbury actually did finally figure it out. Do you know who the Cubs traded in order to get Bob Tewksbury?
I know who the Cardinals traded Bob Tewksbury for.
Who?
Lassie, Jim Edmonds.
Wow. Really?
I don't think it was. The thing about
Edmonds,
the Cubs had tried to trade for him forever. He was Brian Roberts before Brian Roberts. They could never quite figure it out.
And then they got him when he was old. Although they did win a division and he didn't suck. He was old, though. He was not the same.
No, it was a mere shadow of Lassie's former self.
And now I just forgot the question.
I was wrong. It wasn't Bob Tewksbury. Damn it. All right. Well, what was your question, though?
Well, Bob Tewksbury came to the Cubs, I want to say, and I could be wrong, along with Ray Fontenot and along with Cub legend Brian Dayett.
Nope, we're all wrong. I was wrong about Edmonds. You're wrong about this. It was the Yankees.
Steve Trout. It was the Steve Trout trade. Right. That's it. That's
He came over with Rich Scheid and Dean Wilkins.
Wilkins. Yeah.
Shit. I'm pissed off about the Edmonds thing. I thought I knew that.
Yeah.
For years, I've been mad at Bob Tewksbury for that, and it's not his fault.
Steve Trout threw 2 shutouts before that trade.
It was a terrible trade, and now I'm hesitant to look it up.
I don't think it was. Wait, well, Tewksbury to the Cardinals, you mean?
No, like they got Edmonds for. Oh.
Oh, I could tell Junior Kennedy. Adam Kennedy.
Adam Kennedy and Kent Bottenfield. And to me, Kent Bottenfield and Bob Tewksbury are the same guy.
Yeah, no, but, well, it's funny how you brought that full circle inadvertently. But the Bottenfield
full circle inadvertently should be the name of the podcast.
I think we've got something. The annoying part about that is Bottenfield. I would say that Adam Kennedy actually led the Angels to a World Series. I remember he had like a huge LCS, I want to say.
Him and Scott Spezio.
Was that what it was?
They were incredible in that.
So they actually did that. So at one point, that looked like the Angels had the better deal. Edmonds was always a great player for the Cardinals, but they didn't win a World Series till 2006.
Yeah.
And they went in 04. Right. And they went in 04, but that was after the Angels had already won one. So the Angels didn't really regret that in the beginning, and ultimately you can't really say they would have. They got one World Series with Adam Kennedy. So.
Yeah. The only one they've ever won.
Correct.
Do you remember Dave Schwartzbaugh?
Just the name.
Yeah.
437. I could be wrong.
So now this was the year Ramon Tatis pitched for the Cubs. Do you remember what Ramon was most famous for?
Yeah, being a red ass, and Jim Riggleman, who I have to say just typified this sort of Cubs era of mediocrity by design, where even their managers were just vanilla guys named Jim, mostly. But that LeFever shot him down for what it was.
It was Riggleman.
It was Riggleman, right? But it was because he brushed back a hitter, and Riggleman didn't stand up for him.
Yeah,
right. Called him out.
He took him out of the game.
Is that what it was?
Yeah, he didn't call for him to hit the guy, and he did. He hit somebody, and Riggleman went out and took him out. And said, we don't do
I think
that. It's like, well, maybe you
I wanted, and I swear to God, there was another incident that happened on the team bus that might have been related to that or not. So, we remembered the same thing about Ramon Tatis. You have been name-checked, Mr. Tatis.
Rockford's very own Rodney Myers. Pitched on that.
I remember my brother who didn't follow the Cubs as closely as I do, but he's responsible for me being a fan, right? Like, he totally did in the 70s, and he does. He follows it more than the average fan, but he'll defer to me. And he came up to me one point, he goes, wait a second. So the Cubs don't have Randy Myers anymore, right? But there's Rodney Myers? It's like, and the other thing that I think was, I remember seeing people in Wrigleyville with number 59 MY, not Randy Myers was MEYERS.
Yes.
Rodney was MY. And I swear I did not hallucinate this in the 90s. I'm pretty sure it was. But
Randy
there
Myers
were people,
same spelling.
I think it was, maybe it was. Okay. But I know that Rodney Myers, whatever his number was, there were people wearing Rodney Myers jerseys, not Randy Myers.
They were from Rockford, probably.
I didn't know Rodney Myers was from Rockford. So.
East High School in Rockford, Illinois. Give it up for the E-Rabs. Okay. We have to talk about Turk Wendell. So somewhere around here, I have a baseball card of Turk. I use it as a bookmark, under like my Sean Dunstan bookmark. He's in the dugout. He's got his arm wrapped in a towel, and he's brushing his teeth.
Yep.
And you know why he's doing, and anybody who remembers Turk knows why he did it. Turk would chew, didn't want to chew tobacco. He chewed licorice, black licorice. Yep.
Supposedly, he would also dip dirt when he was a minor league.
It would stain his teeth. So he got in the habit of brushing his teeth between innings to keep the licorice from staining his teeth.
Yeah, he was obviously a character, and I always kind of wondered how much of that was sort of an affectation, how much of it was put upon.
He talked to himself on the back of the mound, kind of Mark Bird Fidrich.
Well, yeah, kind of like he was sort of fashioning himself as a Mark Fidrich type. Absolutely.
He jumped, literally leapt over the foul line on his way off the mound after he pitched.
Always, always. Rich, like a lot of players have the superstition about stepping over the line. He just went one further and made a very demonstrative show of leaping over it.
And in 97, in this year, when he took over the closer duties for a little while, when Mel mm-hmm. Rojas was taken out of the role,
yeah,
Turk had this big furry necklace. Do you remember this? That he wore.
Yes.
He had killed some sort of animal, and he was wearing the pelt around his neck. And
I don't remember the pelt. I thought it was the teeth or something.
And it had fur on it. And the other players complained because it smelled. And eventually, umpires said he couldn't wear it while he was pitching because it was, so he had that. So that was fun.
Okay.
Now, 97 is famous for a huge trade.
Oh, yeah, the big Mets trade, which had impact in 1998. You mentioned Brian McCray a few times. Actually, I liked Brian McCray in 1995 and 96. He was a decent player for mediocre by design teams. That did okay. And then I remember him mouthing off in the off season about how the team wasn't doing anything. And I just remember, because I was an idiot, like, you shouldn't say anything, until you get to spring training. But, he did go out and have a shit season. He was terrible in 97.
He was awesome.
So by the time they got rid of him, I was done with him. Because he was already, like, checking out in the off. And it's granted, my boss, Jimmy, who I talked to earlier, he gave up his season tickets there. He was so mad. I wasn't going to give him up. I was disillusioned. I was 25. I just started living in the city. I was not about to. Right. But there were angry, there were people that were not happy going into that season. You kind of sensed that they weren't really had their shit together. That's where I'm coming from.
So do you remember who the Cubs traded to get Brian McCray?
So let me see how much I can remember the trade. They traded Wendell. Who cried?
The trade to get him in the first place. We're gonna start with this one. April 5th, 1995.
From the Royals?
It was right at the end of spring training. Yep.
One of Ed Lynch's first deals. Would I know the guy the Cubs gave up to get McCray?
You're going to know the name, but I don't expect you're going to.
Was it like Mark Parent?
It was Derek Wallace. Do you remember Derek Wallace?
Oh, yeah. Well, I believe Derek Wallace was one of the other Larry Himes' number one draft picks. I might be wrong.
And also Gino Moronis, who I think I think had a yacht rock band.
They can, he can go hang out with, what is it, Rich Scheid and Dean Wilkins, the guys the Cubs got for Bob.
The timing of it, I didn't remember this. I didn't remember that it was April 5th. I mean, it was.
Yeah, I don't either. I don't either.
That never happens.
What were they going to go into their season? Scott Bullitt in center field?
Probably. Okay, so yes. So then a couple of interesting things about the big trade was, you're right, it had some of these guys end up being very important players on the 98 Cubs.
Yep.
But it was a huge trade that happened after the trade deadline.
Yes, because both teams sucked and nobody wanted any of their players, I guess.
The trade started. The initial trade was on August 8th, and then they completed it in phases because guys had
to get
their waivers. Right.
Oh, because I didn't know that. I was associated as one big, like, seven-player trade. And I'm resisting the urge to look at it. Because I have the 97 season up.
All right. We'll see how much we can remember. The Cubs traded three guys. Can you name the
Cubs
three
traded
Cubs?
McCray and Wendell. I'm going to have to come back to the next one. So they got four back. They got Mark Clark and Lance Johnson. So they got their game one starter of the 98 LCS and their center leadoff man. So the Cubs
game one starter by default.
Everyone else had their arm in a sling. They were just soaking in a tub of ice. We'll talk about that down the stretch team in 98.
Okay, I will say that the two players you're missing, it was a 3-for-3 trade.
Oh, it's a 3-for-3. They're missing one on each side.
You're missing one, and there are two guys we've already talked about. extensively.
They've already been mentioned?
Yes.
See, now I'm going to try too hard. So I got McCray. These are guys that started on the 97 Cubs. Was one a catcher?
No.
I have to give up, even though we've mentioned it. Nope. I just can't. I don't have the right context.
So the Cub you missed was Mel Rojas.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. And they dumped him before his first year.
And the Met you missed was Manny Alexander.
Oh.
That's how they got the great Manny Alexander. So the trade was, on August 8th, the Cubs traded, because these guys had already gotten through waivers, amazing, Brian McCray, Mel Rojas, and Turk Wendell to the Mets for Lance Johnson and two players named later.
Who on became?
On August 11th, 3 days later, they got Mark Clark. And yes. It took a long time to get Manny through because he's such a star. August 14th.
His bag kept getting checked as it came through.
But you never see a six-player waiver. Of course, you can't. Now that waiver trades aren't a thing. But up until 2 years ago, they were.
Right.
And
right.
You never saw six players. That was just a good example of how bad the teams were and how little anybody else thought of their talent. Because wouldn't you have thought somebody would have claimed Brian McCray or Lance Johnson?
Right,
just to you're be an extra outfielder on a good team going down the playoffs, and they both and made it through.
Right. I'm not trying to be cute, but you mean the most players for a two-team trade? Because I almost want to say the Nomar trade for the Cubs, which had four.
But that wasn't a waiver trade. They did it at the deadline.
It was at the deadline. Yeah, that's right.
The biggest one recently was the Justin Verlander one. I think it was three players for him.
Yes, and the Cubs already had Cole Hamels.
The Cubs fucked that up so bad. They were negotiating with him until the very end, until the deadline. He wanted to go there. The Tigers were trying to make it work. And the Cubs got cute and said, all right, the Ricketts basically said, we don't need to add that. They basically had a wink-wink agreement with Verlander that they would revisit it in the offseason and trade for him then, which made no sense. They needed him right away. Then all they had to do to hedge their bet was claim him and tell the Tigers, oh, we're not going to give you anything for him right now. Well, they couldn't. Right. The Tigers weren't just going to give him away. They could have blocked him. Instead, they let him go through, and the Astros got him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if it'd make a difference.
Nice job, Theo. I don't know why everybody thinks Theo was so good.
We'll leave that.
He only won three World Series. That's all.
I know. We'll leave that for another podcast. Yeah.
Another guy that made his big league debut in 1997, God rest his soul.
Oh, wait, hold on. There were three.
That's right. We should talk about this. This was bring out the 97 your dad. Team was cursed.
Bring out your dead. There are three pitchers, starting pitchers, and they all pitched a long time together because Kevin Foster, who grew up at Evanston, his dad was a CTA driver. He's made his debut. He was traded for Sean Boskey. He shows up in 95, and he's pretty much on the team from then. Castillo came up a little bit earlier, 92. And Jeremy Gonzalez made his debut in 97. So they were all part of the rotation in 1997. And to quote the late ABC sports guy, Jim McKay, they're all gone.
So do you remember the Brian McCray, Frank Castillo story?
I was at that game, but I didn't get there early enough in batting practice to see the home run. But Frank Castillo, even for a pitcher, is this a story?
Yes.
You might have a twist to it. So I'll tell the straight story as I recall it being told to the box office, the press box wags. I was actually at the game that it happened. I was sitting in the bleachers, but it happened in batting practice. And there probably wasn't too many people in the park because, of course, when the home team or the Cubs take batting practice, if you want to see, you're only going to see about the last 20 minutes of it before you watch the road team. But in that batting practice, Frank Castillo, who even for a pitcher was a notoriously awful hitter, it was proffered a bet by Brian McCray that if he could hit on just a batting practice pitch over the ivy covered wall in batting practice at Wrigley Field, that McCray would, I believe, purchase him a car. And lo and behold, at some point, and I think it may have happened in 97, but then I think, you know what? Castillo got traded later in 97 to Colorado. This is actually Castillo's, I think his future partner in death, Jeremy Gonzalez, may have replaced him. But yeah, so are there details to that story, though? Or is there something?
Well, I'll tell you. Guess who's going to fill in the details? We're going to the Times of Northwest Indiana. George Castle, ooh, writing on May 31st, 1997. The headline, Cubs Castillo wins a car, loses a game.
Okay.
George writes, Frank Castillo may have a new career on Wheel of Fortune. The Cubs pitcher might need one because his starting rotation days could be numbered unless he turns the season around fast. Anyway, Castillo got the best consolation prize ever for a pitcher getting shelled out of the game for the second straight start. He won a three-year-old bet with center fielder Brian McRae. Castillo and his wife, Tracy, will be one Mercedes richer as a result. God, even he's really overwriting all of this. Basically, you're right.
Okay. I'm going to add one pointless celebrity encounter to this game. I swear this is the same game, and I don't know how you could verify it, but I think it was with Oleg. We were in the center field bleachers. We got there kind of late. That's why I didn't see the home run. And watching the game, I looked down into the right field bleachers, right? So you're kind of above. You're on a perch a little bit if you're up in center field. And I see what is like the unmistakable sort of pompadour of a one Dan Patrick.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, I was able to spot. I'm like, wait a sec. Look at that here. That's Dan Patrick. So I kept my eye on him during the game. I'm like, that's totally Dan Patrick. I just purchased. I was, you know, I enjoyed like any guy in the 90s, the late show. Is that what they called it? I forget what they called it. But the Big Show. That's what they nicknamed. They wrote a book together. Yep. You probably bought it too.
I didn't.
I read it.
I read it somehow.
Yeah. I bought it. I read it. And it was right around that time. And so I was kind of big on it. So I'm usually pretty demure. If I see a celebrity in public, you know, I'm not going to bother him. But when the game ended, he was still just hanging out. He was just hanging out as a fan. He must have been in town for work. In fact, I don't know. What's the date on the George Castle story?
May 31st, 1987.
Yeah, he's probably in town for the Bulls.
NBA, you know, sure
conference semifinals or something. So after the game, I started making my way outside. He was just hanging out. He was not in a hurry to leave. I went all the way down. I went up to him and I shook his hand and I just said, you know, I just bought your book. And he made a funny joke. Oh, you're the one, you know, that old kind of joke. You're the, he was very self-effacing and funny, and I didn't want to take up much of his time and, you know, try to hang out with him. But that was my celebrity encounter in the right field bleachers. But pretty sure it was the same day that Frank Castillo won his ass a Mercedes. And then
according to George, the original bet was a joint bet between Brian McRae and Jaime Navarro. Had, I guess, Jamie. He was both.
I called him Jaime.
Between him changing his name and Jeremy Gonzalez changing from a J to a G, getting struck by lightning on a beach.
What was wrong with the 97 Cubs? My God. They were like cursed.
to this day, most hilarious former baseball player death. Do you remember how Bo Diaz died?
Putting up a satellite dish?
A satellite dish fell on him and killed him.
Oh, Jesus.
Now, it wasn't the little DirecTV pizza box size one. It was the big,
right. No, but still, we had a neighbor that had a satellite. It was just
crushed by his own satellite.
A fourth of their backyard.
So apparently the original bet was by both of them. Unfortunately for Brian, he was the only one around still in 97, so he had to buy the Mercedes.
Okay.
But they had told Frank that he was the worst hitter they'd ever seen, and they knew he could never hit a home run in a game or batting practice, okay. And they felt very safe. And then just 2 short months before he was shipped off to the Mets, poor Brian had to pay up. Actually, so Frank probably got traded before Brian did.
Yes, get traded after the death. I remember, I want to say Castillo, got traded, and then shortly after pitched against the Cubs at Wrigley Field. I could be.
I could be very wrong, but I seem to remember Frank Castillo's wife. Super
very attractive. Yes. Yeah. Well, I'm going to tie a few things together. Even though
not Mark DeRosa's wife attractive, because correct. Mark DeRosa's wife may be the greatest looking baseball player wife of all time.
I need to tie together a few things, even though this happened in 1995. I was in attendance when Frank Castillo threw 8 2/3 no-hit ball.
Oh, yeah.
I was at the game. Oleg was there. I actually was not even drinking because I was on some weird diet. I was trying to lose weight and I couldn't drink. So I was going out of my mind. In fact, just to tie it in, it was a late September game. I know that the Lions pulled a rare upset on the 49ers on Monday Night Football. We saw at the Cubby Bear after the game. But there weren't a lot of fans, although the Cubs ended up, you know, they were not even eliminated. And it was the final week of the season, but it was after the strike. It was a weird time. We were able to get a lot of tickets really cheap that year. And it was fresh because I was right out of college and I was poor. And I went to a lot of Cubs games. But I think these are the ones where we're sitting in the seats that my cousin had that I would eventually have a part of. But what we did was we were able to move down and go closer to the wall. And we were right behind the bullpen. And we were all anxious, and I tapped Turk Wendell, who was sitting in the bullpen, because, you know, back then you could just tap a bullpen member on the shoulder, and asked him to give me some of the dirt that I could, you know, just to put on the show, because they said that
Turk
Wendell would dip dirt. No, and I did, because I was – right, because I was a 23-year-old idiot. But I know that Wendell would dip dirt, so I wanted to show some camaraderie for him, and he thought it was pretty fucking weird. But viewers at home – which I was not aware of this. I was made aware of this after, but viewers at home were made very aware of Frank's wife, Kathy, because I believe
Tracy.
Tracy Castillo, because in all of the hubbub over Frank almost throwing a no-hitter, Arnie Harris made it a point to, you know, sort Arnie of was, accentuate the drama.
Yes. Arnie was good at getting shots of the lake and shots of attractive women dressed for the weather.
That's right. The hat shots, which I didn't know was a euphemism as a kid. So, but that was 1995, not 1997.
Oh, well,
but,
I'm glad you didn't save that for the 95 one.
Right. It might come back, though. And if it is, I don't want to hear
it. I'll just edit this out and drop it in that one, because I'm sure I'll remember to do that.
All
right. So we had a request today. I don't know if you saw this.
Yes.
So Mike Prusnowski, our Twitter follower friend.
Yes. Good guy.
Posted a poll question that he wanted us to weigh in on.
Yes.
And it was, which Chicago sports drought took you by most surprise when you first became aware of it as a kid? And the four choices were the Cubs World Series championship drought, hearkening back to 1908, the White Sox World Series drought back to 1917, the Blackhawks Stanley Cup drought to 61, or the fact that the Bears hadn't had a competent quarterback since the 40s.
Right. So I voted the Cubs, and I'll tell you why. But then when I saw your answer, I was like, that is the right answer. And it's actually true. Let me just first say why I took the Cubs, because I was getting into the Cubs in 1980. This is what this is kind of about. 1980. Shortly after Dallas Green took over after the Tribune Company bought the team in 82, they, you know, started cleaning the place up and they got in, started selling some merchandise. But I remember that they were selling these shirts that said 1908. And I remember it because we had a relative in the family, a cousin by marriage, who was from New York and was a Yankees fan. Insufferable. Great, good guy. But, you know, when it came to sports, he was insufferable and was not shy about, hey, I see the Cubs have some new merchandise celebrating the last World Series, 1908, you know. What are you going to say? And I was like, wow, that really is a long-ass time ago. So that's all. I mean, it was just because
you didn't know enough at the time to go, that's right, a whopping 9 years longer than your awesome team's drought.
And that's the thing. It's like, really, for Sox fans that bitch about all of the media outlets that forget about their so-called 2005 World Series, get equal protection by people forgetting, you know, we didn't even know. You're right. It was like the White Sox were just as bad as the Red Sox and Cubs, and it was never discussed. You wouldn't know about it otherwise. That is the only right answer.
Well, and the White Sox dined out for a long time on the fact that, well, we were really good. We had good teams in the 50s.
Yeah.
But the Yankees were in our
fine. That was their only golden era.
But they still, to this day, they've never made the playoffs in back-to-back years, ever.
Yeah, yeah.
They went just as long a streaks where they were terrible as the Cubs.
No, let me tell you something. Between the time they threw the World Series in 1919 and 1959, when they went back, that set a major league record for what was then, you know, longest World Series drought. But then in the modern era, it became the longest playoff drought. And I only knew about this, and I learned about this in 1984, when the Cubs went back to the playoffs for the first time in 39 years. So obviously, the World Series drought is longer than what the Sox, but the Sox still hold the longest postseason drought having gone from 1919 to 1959 without a pennant. Now, when you also factor in that their only other pennants before 1919, when they beat the Giants in 1917, and of course beat the Cubs in 1906, of the original six teams, they've won the fewest pennants. They've been to five World Series. Even the Phillies, who were only had won two pennants till Dallas Green, you know, took them to all the way in 1980, have surpassed them. The Indians, who have had long stretches, have surpassed them. So it really, of the original 16 teams, if you want to look at that, I know it's not hockey, but there are 16 original extant franchises, okay, that have, you know, some have moved from, you know, to multiple cities, some haven't. There's beyond a shadow of a doubt that the Sox are the most piss-poor franchise of all of them. Even the St. Louis Browns, who only won one pennant in a war-torn season with a one-armed outfielder, still became the Baltimore Orioles and won three World Series.
So my answer to that was the White Sox. I gave a joke answer, which was I didn't even know they were a thing until I got to college.
Right.
But I literally never knew a White Sox fan until I went to Northern. I'd never met one. I didn't know anybody who actually rooted for the
White
Sox.
Not one?
Not a single one. Everybody I knew were Cub fans or didn't care about baseball. It was one or the other.
No Twins fans or Brewers fans?
Well, there were probably some Brewer fans.
Okay.
But everybody I knew that liked baseball liked the Cubs. So that wasn't even a thing. I didn't give a shit about the White Sox. And I still mostly don't. I like to make fun of them, but I really don't care. But when I got to college, you know, I was there from 91 to 95.
Yep.
The White Sox were good. And the Cubs were not. And I took an endless amount of shit from Sox fan, you know, there's a lot of South suburban assholes that go to Northern.
Yes.
And I live with most of them. And so I had to, I learned a lot about the White Sox in a short amount of time so that I could argue with them.
Yeah. Oh, boy. That was your first mistake.
Yeah. Well, they had to argue with me. So.
Yeah, so I grew up with the animal. I inherited. I remember like, hey, can I root for the White Sox, too? And I was like, no. He's like, I did the same thing. And then my dad sat me down and told me how they threw the World Series in 19. I mean, it's more complicated than that. But, yeah, but I mean.
I feel bad for Mike because he put the poll question up at the wrong possible day because he puts it up. And then the Bears go out and they completely solve their quarterback dilemma by signing Andy Dalton, who you just add a T to me and you get him. And
yeah, I did actually have to do a double thing at one point. I'm like, wait a second, Andy Dalton.
We have the exact same name except he's got a T thrown in there. Otherwise, every letter is exactly the same.
And an A and O transpose.
Well, you got to move them around, but they're the same letters. We're like 85% the same guy. I can't wait to boo the shit out of myself.
It's gonna be awesome. I think I promise you that even against your will, I'm going to drag you to a game. So you're going to get your wish.
I'm going to be throwing feces onto the field, and I don't even care if it's mine. That's how upset I'm going to be.
Yeah.
All right. So one down, 31 to go.
Hey. We got through really one of the most miserable seasons in Cubs history.
When that came up, it's like, it's a gift and a curse.
Right.
There's a lot there, but it's all bad.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe you got to do a little bit of work. It's still kind of easy for me to, you know,
my time for, what would it be, 81? I got a Ken Reed story, and I can't wait. That might be the only thing I can talk. Actually, 81 I can talk about because it was the first game I ever went to was in 81.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No, we can stretch those. I think there's something about the older seasons that it's a simple thing. It's also part of the reason why we're not doing anything from the last five or six seasons that the longer you go, the more they age.
When it just happened, we'd better be able to remember it.
Yes. I mean, this is why I'm going to be really.
I don't know if you remember
this,
Mike. Do you remember the Ben Zobrist got a double in game seven? Yes. We all remember.
Yes. No. Yeah. But it's like, no. Do you remember when, Dan Briggs hit a double into the corner in Montreal Stadium?
I can tell you, I don't remember Dan Briggs.
So I think he was on the 81 Cubs. So I never would have expected. I think Dan Briggs would never have expected his name to be name checked. But there it is. So,
all right. Well, until next time, when we spin the wheel of death and see what Cub season we get,
I'll be ready.
All right. Well, thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Andy.
Many of us have herpes.